Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives as our faculty review actual cases of patients with advanced gastroesophageal cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Jeff Kew from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and Dr. Zev Weinberg from the UCLA School of Medicine. As in all of our programs, we will be discussing the use of non-approved agents and regimens, so check out the prescribing information for each product for more specific information. So over the last couple of weeks, I've actually spent an hour and a half with 11 different oncologists getting cases and questions to bring up for the ASCO meeting, but also for this webinar. And you'll see these six docs presenting cases and questions that they have, and really, I think, reflecting what I've been hearing over the last week. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of an ASCO preview, because even though we were intending to just cover metastatic disease, we cannot resist the temptation to talk a little bit about the two big plenary presentations that are going to be out there in localized disease. We'll get to that in a second. We'll talk about HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancers and the use of immunotherapy, as well as targeting of claudin with zolbetuximab and more. So just to start out with the ASCO preview, before we kind of get into that, I just want to bring up a really basic issue. And I brought this up a lot of times over the years. And, you know, I'm kind of a simple person, Zeb, but sometimes the simple things elude me. And I just want to start out with your vision of how you think through gastroesophageal cancers in terms of anatomy and histology. Because again, in talking to these docs over the last couple of weeks, I see confusion, particularly in the post-neoadjuvant setting, cross versus flat, where does it fit in? And IO, when you look at trials that we're going to talk about today, and sometimes you'll see adeno in the esophagus and, you know, squamous lower down and near the GE junction. So Zev, how do you sort of simplify it for how to look at this, not even getting into HER2 and MSI, but just to look at the anatomy and histology and bring it into clinical context?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's great to be here again, Neil. Thanks for doing this as always. So, I mean, I think for esophageal adenocarcinoma and gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma and gastric adenocarcinoma, we've now centralized behind FLOT as the ideal treatment option. That was made clear, I think, last year to a large extent in the ESOPEC trial, which was published in New England in last year's ASCO presentation, where it was superior to cross in the neoadjuvant perioperative treatment of esophageal adeno. And we've known for a few years that's the way we ought to be treating gastric adeno. So now I think we have some simplicity around the treatment of all the way through adenocarcinomas of the esophagus down. Now, I don't mean that should be extrapolated to every single patient, but that's something that by and large is a reasonable consensus. Squamous cell carcinoma that is resectable, we still would consider the cross regimen to be the standard of care, followed by surgery, followed by adjuvant nivolumab. We will see some updated overall survival results of the CheckMate 577 study at ASCO, which will clarify the extent of the survival advantage, if there is one at all, to adjuvant nivolumab in esophageal cancer. For gastroesophageal cancer, and that includes all the way esophagus, stomach, and down, we, as you alluded to, will see some very interesting data with the Matterhorn study, which was perioperative treatment, adding durvalumab to FLOT chemotherapy. So it has gotten a little simpler in some respects, I would argue.
So, and then Jeff, you know, we were just talking, or Dev was talking about FLOT versus cross, and, you know, I saw this cartoon with the two cavemen there, one saying, just because the neighbor got fire doesn't mean we need to. And I thought about that the neighbor without the fire was FLOT, and the neighbor with the fire, or the IO, was the cross regimen that oncs keep asking me about, the FLOT patients and IO, and they see what's going on with the cross patients. And to get into that, I want to let you take a look at a case that is something I've heard many, many times I'm sure you have as well in Second Opinion. And before we get into the Matterhorn presentation, I'm going to ask for your thoughts on this. Is Dr. Fred Divers.
This is a 73-year-old man from southern Louisiana who moved here to Arkansas. He developed some dysphagia, had an EGD with a biopsy that showed an adenocarcinoma in the distal third. Staging PET CT showed N2 disease. He didn't interestingly have a somatic BRCA mutation. And so for that reason, I felt perhaps, you know, a higher dose or more significant exposure to platinum may be helpful. He was treated with 4 cycles of FLOT in the neoadjuvant setting and then underwent esophagogastrectomy. I actually saw him back this week. He's recovered quite well from his surgery. He's just a little over 2 weeks out, but his pathologic disease still had a T3 lesion and had 3 nodes that were still involved. And interestingly, the comment on the pathology report was that he really had minimal tumor regression or response noted histologically, though clinically his dysphagia completely resolved as soon as we started his treatment. What would the role for immune checkpoint inhibitor be here? And then the question I always ask myself, even though we never have data, is, you know, would there ever be a role for off-label use of a PARP or something in that space? We're in this sort of data free zone. So I think I'd love to see some data that shows that FLOT plus surgery followed by immune checkpoint inhibitor, you know, created a larger lift there. This guy looked phenomenal. Like literally, I was off 2 peds in less than 3 weeks and maintained his weight and looked like a rose. But when I read the PATH report that says really minimal treatment effect, it sort of gives me significant pause about exposing him to that toxicity. And then, you know, I'm really scrambling, thinking about other options there, but he's actually coming in 2 weeks to begin his postoperative FLOT. But I'd be open to any and all suggestions to the contrary here.
So, Jeff, I saw you shaking your head many times as you listen to that story that I know you've heard so many times before.
Yeah.
And it's really great because I just talked to Dr. Diver. This did this a few days ago. So the patient's coming back in a couple weeks. There's going to be some new information out there because, of course, we have this big plenary presentation from the Matterhorn study. We had seen previously some data on PCR, but now we're going to see data on events-free survival. Hopefully, maybe we can integrate your thoughts into what the Dr. Divers does when he sees the patient, including his thought or your thoughts about this patient having a BRCA somatic mutation. So, Jeff, any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a ton of thoughts. And I think, you know, this is absolutely, I think this is essentially a scenario we've encountered ever since, you know, perioperative chemotherapy became the standard of care. So I think the broader question is, if someone has preoperative chemotherapy, currently FLOT used to be, you know, some epirubicin 3-drug combination, if they have poor pathologic response, what do you do? So even kind of outside of an immunotherapy question, and I think I think there's never been an answer to that question. I think our group certainly feels strongly that if you have a poor response to FLOT, certainly you should not change to a different chemotherapy regimen with irinotecan-based therapy, for example. And again, looking at the data, augmentation of chemotherapy in this way is probably not helpful. So I think that, you know, I think maybe broadly speaking, there are 3 options. One option is to do nothing. You declare that the cancer is just, you know, chemotherapy resistant and you switch to observation. I think the second option, and I think a strong inclination would be to add, you know, immunotherapy, potentially durvalumab after June 1st to FLOT. Or the third option is just merely to complete the FLOT alone. Right. And in fact, I actually had a similar discussion, you know, with a colleague of mine. And, you know, I think that, Matterhorn, you know, we know from the press release is positive. So in other words, the addition of durvalumab to perioperative FLOT improves event-free survival. So I think one would be tempted, again, to plug durvalumab into his adjuvant treatment. But I would also clarify that his treatment paradigm does not fall into that of Matterhorn, right? Because in Matterhorn, patients receive 4 cycles of preoperative FLOT, the 4 cycles of postoperative FLOT, and then they were randomized to get FLOT along with that, plus an additional, I think, 8 to 10 months of adjuvant FLOT. And if it's positive, we will never know which part of the FLOT, which part of the durvalumab is necessary, the preoperative component, the adjuvant component, or the pure, you know, durvalumab monotherapy for 8 to 10 months. But again, I think that, you know, one certainly would be tempted to think about integrating durvalumab, you know, into adjuvant treatment. So additional four cycles of FLOT with durvalumab. But I would say then something I'm absolutely looking forward to is in terms of the subgroup analysis, whether PD-L1, you know, determines the likelihood of benefiting from durvalumab. We certainly know that, you know, also 7 to 8% of locally advanced gastric cancer is MSI. I'm sure those patients will have outsized benefit. But for the MSS PD-L1 positive, PD-L1 negative patients, you know, can we begin to tease out how much benefit they get? So I think this will figure heavily into the discussion. But the last study that I would bring up, which is really kind of food for thought and kind of, you know, pauses this a little bit. So Attraction 5 was an East Asian study that randomized patients who had upfront surgery alone to adjuvant chemotherapy with or without nivolumab. And it is, essentially, it was a flatly negative study. It was a well-conducted study. It was a simple question. And there was no benefit for adjuvant nivolumab with chemotherapy. Now, that also doesn't fit into, you know, the scenario of Dr. Diver's patient who did get preoperative chemotherapy alone. But if you look at Attraction 5, you know, maybe giving immunotherapy in the pure adjuvant setting with chemo is not beneficial. So, I mean, I guess I don't have an answer to the question, but I think based on, you know, what we'll hear on June 1st, I think we might be inclined to start adding immunotherapy, durvalumab specifically, if we can get it approved through insurance, you know, before it becomes part of NCCN guidelines, before it becomes FDA approved.
And so interesting to note here, though, in the trial design, they give the durvalumab with the chemo pre-op as well. So obviously this patient, Dr. Diver's patient, has already had his therapy. Here's exactly the press release that we were talking about. Zev, I want to ask you also about this study, which is dealing with the question, I don't think we've seen a phase 3 study. And also, Zev, if you can comment on the BRCA somatic mutation in Dr. Diver's patient, his comment about maybe pushing more on platinum, but also would you ever use a PARP inhibitor patient in a third, fourth line therapy? And then Zev, any predictions on the big question of are we going to see benefit and how much benefit of IO in the adjuvant setting for MSI high? Now we're talking about colon, but it's such a huge paper, I got to ask you all. So Zev, any kind of comment about the BRCA2, any predictions here?
Yeah, Neil. So I think first for Dr. Diver's patients, I mean, I agree with Jeff. I think we know the study's positive. It's a question of degree of positivity. But in real life and practical reality, I would offer that patient an IO therapy plus FLOT based on what I've seen and based on what we know to be the case with that Matterhorn study. So in a healthy patient who can handle more FLOT, despite a disappointing pathological response. It doesn't, it's never been clear, and it's certainly not clear to a large extent in the long-term clinical data that pathological response is as important as we might reflexively think it is. But Jeff's points are well taken, and particularly with what's the part of this that's necessary. And unfortunately, we just won't have answers for that anytime soon. So for Dr. Diver's patient in 2 weeks, I would strongly consider that as an option. BRCA patient, I mean, we have no data here. It's a very unusual thing and certainly less common in gastric than in pancreas, for example. I would consider it, but only as a refractory option for a PARP inhibitor. But I do, in principle, think that, hey, there's another reason why giving the guy a little bit more platinum or giving that patient a little bit more platinum makes sense scientifically. Regarding this study, so we know that this study, we think this study is a positive study. What that means is that in MSI-high colon cancer, at least from a disease-free survival perspective, the addition of checkpoint inhibitor may improve long-term disease-free survival in metastatic in adjuvant MSI-high colorectal cancer with atezolizumab. The question, I think, which will remain unanswered, which is unfortunately not captured in the study, is do we need the chemotherapy at all? And I think, and we've known for a long time in MSI-high that maybe we don't need chemotherapy, and that's been shown in a number of studies over the years across malignancies. So we'll learn something from this, and hopefully we'll learn that it's a very big benefit with the addition of immunotherapy over chemotherapy. But I'm more interested in seeing the arm that wasn't done, which is the performance of a checkpoint inhibitor alone in this patient population, which I think is the subject of another study, which maybe we'll see in the next year or two.
So, yeah, I think when you said the question is, everybody in the audience knew exactly what the question was going to be, because that, you know, happens even in trials of metastatic disease where you don't have a separate arm with just IO. So another big ASCO presentation, Jeff, is going to be on the antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan. We're going to start out our discussion with a discussion of HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer. We'll get into T-DXd in a second as we get into that, but we're going to start out with first-line therapy. But, Jeff, we do know that, again, there's this way it is in oncology nowadays. You see a press release that before you see the paper, and I don't think it's a huge surprise that T-DXd is beating ramucirumab and docetaxel. But anything you're going to be particularly looking for, Jeff, in this study?
I mean, I don't think the study, I agree with your point that I don't think there's any surprise about the results. So, you know, DESTINY-Gastric01 and DESTINY-Gastric02, I mean, I was involved with 02. Actually, you know, they had very, very similar results. So the first was a randomized phase 2 study in East Asian patients in the third line setting. DESTINY-Gastric02 was a single arm phase 2 study in the second line setting in Western patients, and they had very, very similar results. And on paper, you know, both of the T-DXd, you know, subgroup and the group of patients did better than what we would expect historically from ramucirumab paclitaxel. So it really was in this context that DESTINY-Gastric04 was launched to definitively answer the question. Notably, it was an ex-US study. It did not enroll in the US because T-DXd was approved in the US as post-trastuzumab therapy, meaning that we could give it a second-line treatment. But again, the press release suggests that it's positive, and I fully believe it. And we know, you know, that response rates are about 40% for T-DXd, you know, versus historically 27% for ramucirumab paclitaxel. I guess what I would be looking for is just to see, you know, how both, you know, both experiments, I mean, both groups compare to the historical data. You know, and I think also it would be interesting to see, you know, when they look at it by Asia versus rest of world, whether there are any differences that emerge. Because certainly I think an ongoing question, I think especially when it comes to anti-angiogenic therapy in gastric, you know, is whether there is a differential benefit between East Asia and rest of world. But again, this was I think it's reassuring, but not necessarily, you know, an unexpected result.
So again, Zev, in a second, we'll get into how we treat HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer today. But thinking about the future, as you know, and one of the most anticipated papers for ASCO is DESTINY-Breast09. We've been looking for this for the last couple of years. First-line metastatic disease, HER2-positive breast cancer. This is going to be presented. We know it's positive. The question is how positive. I think there's a lot of optimism that maybe T-DXd is going to become a part of. This is actually with pertuzumab in that arm, part of standard care. First-line metastatic breast cancer. Zev, do you think we're heading in the same direction? Are there trials out there looking at T-DXd in the first line? And do you think in the next few years maybe it's going to be moving up?
I mean, I think for breast cancer, it seems like T-DXd, everybody gets T-DXd at some point, as right. far as I can tell. So I don't right. think we're headed there in gastric cancer. I think the difference is that, you know, in gastric cancer, we need a little more chemotherapy for an all-comer patient population. Now, we know that T-DXd is going to have I call it a reaffirming study at ASCO that we've just been chatting about. It's going to reaffirm what we kind of already thought. Moving at the front line will be a test. And in particular, in those so-called HER2-low patients that everybody treats in breast cancer, that's a whole different ballgame in gastric cancer, in my view. So we're a long way off for that, Neil.
So let's get into a couple cases of HER2-positive disease, starting out with this case of Dr. Mulheran, who, interestingly, of course, in general, you know, now we have a pan-tumor approval for IHC3 plus with T-DXd, but also, particularly in lung cancer, we see a lot of HER2 mutant disease, where even in some cases, T-DXd is used first line, and this patient actually had both. And here's the case and the questions from Dr. Mulheran. All right, 64-year-old man.
So, you know, he, you know, dysphagia, 15-pound weight loss, had iron deficiency anemia. He had a mass that was seen at the GE junction, moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. So he had liver mets, unfortunately, at diagnosis, but his PD-L1 was zero. His HER2 IHC is 3+. And interestingly, he also had this HER2 mutation. He had started out on pembro trastuzumab chemo. These mutations are rare in esophageal cancer. So if he progresses on frontline treatment, would you consider doing something like TXEs? What if the patient was HER2 IHC zero, but then also had a mutation, which I've also seen, almost what you might see in like non-small cell lung cancer, right? What happens if they have a CR? How long are you going to keep them on therapy? Are you going to get rid of the pembro at 2 years? Kind of what we, you know, do you ever stop the trastuzumab? I've had a couple patients who they, it was just like 3 or 4 years out and we've stopped the maintenance therapy and then they almost immediately progress. But would you do that here?
So, Jeff, interesting questions about this case. I'm curious if you have any thoughts in terms of, you know, I've seen a bunch of cases we presented. You know, when we saw first the 811 study with the approval of pembro, adding now to the chemo and trastuzumab. Initially, it was for all PD-1, and so I saw a bunch of patients like this one who were treated in that window before the FDA and the data came out showing it didn't work in that 15%, as we alluded to. But any thoughts about this patient with HER2 mutant disease and also his question about second line therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think one question is probably easier to answer than the other. So HER2 mutations in esophagogastric are extremely rare. And I think ultimately we simply don't know, you know, I think the predictive benefit of something like TDXD or even trastuzumab. So I think I would focus, I think, certainly on the more standard component. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, I think in that window period, he would have, you know, very appropriately received pembrotraz chemo. But today, you know, 15% of HER2 positive tumors are actually PD-L1 negative, and it really would be trastuzumab chemotherapy alone. Now, the data are somewhat buried, and actually it was buried in the EMA approval for pembrolizumab with trastuzumab and chemotherapy. There actually was a suggestion, and I think it's really more of a suggestion than anything else. It's certainly not anything we should accept as fact, that the addition of pembrolizumab to trastuzumab and chemotherapy for PD-L1 negative tumors, you know, the point estimate for the hazard ratio was actually about 1.3, meaning that there was actually an increased risk of dying with adding pembrolizumab. Now, again, I think it's speculative, but I think it's fair to say that there is no benefit for adding pembrolizumab to trastuzumab and chemotherapy in a PD-L1 negative tumor. So I think that, I mean, what we would do today is clear. I think there were a couple of other questions that he had asked, but I think maybe the somewhat easier question to answer is, you know, if the tumor at the time of progression on first line trastuzumab based chemotherapy, my strong recommendation always is to try and biopsy a progressing lesion to confirm whether it remains HER2 positive, because we know about 30% of the time, you know, HER2 positivity is lost as a mechanism of resistance, right? And I think that if the tumor remains HER2 positive, irrespective of the presence of a HER2 mutation, then I think it's pretty standard. I think TDXD certainly, I think TDXD has always been the standard of care in the US, but, you know, DESTINY-Gastric04 will reaffirm that it's superior to ramucirumab paclitaxel. Now, I think the question that he asked is, what if it's IHC zero and is HER2 mutated? I would say that we certainly do not have any data. I would be certainly cautious about, you know, extrapolating data from lung cancer to gastric cancer. And I think, you know, Zev also kind of, you know, made this point that HER2 low breast cancer response. So HER2 low breast cancer has a higher response rate to trastuzumab deruxtecan than HER2 positive gastric cancer does to trastuzumab deruxtecan. So when we're talking about HER2 low, certainly talking about HER2 negative, you know, in gastric cancer, totally different entity than something like breast. And we certainly shouldn't be extrapolating data from one disease type to another.
So, Zev, when I heard this case, I thought about you, because I remember a case you presented in one of our programs a few years ago of a patient with a gastroesophageal cancer who developed brain mets. And I was asking you, do you see that more with HER2? I think you were trying to get tucatinib for the patient. I don't know what happened, because that was a couple years ago when tucatinib was all hot for brain mets and breast. Now TDXD looks like it works really well in the brain. But anyhow, Zev, I want you to listen to this case. This is a patient, not only HER2 positive, but also this was PD-1 positive, CPS of 10. The patient got a chemo, pembro, trastuzumab, and then maintenance. And here's what happened.
This is an 86-year-old male who was diagnosed with a metastatic esophageal cancer in October of 2022. He had fairly extensive liver and lung metastases. He was HER2 positive 3+ by IHC with a PD-L1 score of 10. He had reasonable functional status, so we treated him with a modified FOLFOX-based regimen together with trastuzumab and pembrolizumab. And then we dropped oxaliplatin and transitioned to 5-FU maintenance together with pembrolizumab and trastuzumab. And he was on that for almost 2 years and then unfortunately developed CNS metastases with ongoing complete response systemically, completely disease-free in the liver and lung, as well as the esophageal area, but developed fairly extensive brain metastases. And again, given his older age, rapid functional decline, he was not able to receive any other additional therapy and also elected to go on to palliative hospice care.
So what are the questions you have about him?
How do we interpret HER2 amplification in G-junction cancer? Is there any role for some newer agents such as trastuzumab deruxtecan in the frontline treatment of patients who are HER2 positive with metastatic gastric or GE junction cancers?
So, you know, when I saw that CNS met thing, I was hoping I was going to see the patient got TDXD because, you know, we're seeing pretty good responses in breast to TDXD in the brain. Was that something you wanted to do? He was just too sick.
Yes, that was exactly my plan. And we had a lot of family discussions, but basically he had an ECOG of 3 and it was just thought to be too challenging. And I think at that time he was 88 years old. So family elected to transition to palliative care.
So Zev, any thoughts?
I think first of all, it's we're seeing it more and more. The reality is that HER2 positive disease has more of a predilection to go to the brain. Just like it does in breast cancer. The second reality is that patients are living longer with these cancers. So this is not an uncommon scenario where patients have a great response to frontline chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and trastuzumab, and then have sanctuary sites emerge, and one of them being the CNS. So I've seen this a number of times, and I would treat the patient much the same way. There's no way to prevent sometimes these brain lesions from occurring. But once it occurs, and if the patient's in decent status, performance status, if we're so fortunate, that would be an optimal. I agree with TDXD there, because it does have some CNS penetration, and you've seen that in breast. And one would, we don't have a large data set to confirm that in gastric, but that is a logical, very logical assumption. We don't know if it'll work as well. But that is how I would certainly approach the patient. The point that Jeff has made is an excellent one, which is that there is a decent amount of data showing that a lot of these patients are no longer HER2 positive, that simply developing resistance due to whether it's selected pressure or whatever reason, they're no longer HER2 positive. So if you can't do a biopsy on a secondary lesion, you certainly can consider that's a good use of ctDNA, in my view, to Agreed. See if they're still HER2 positive. Because I have a lot of patients who have another site, and then it turns out they're no longer HER2 positive. So treating them with TDXD doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense necessarily.
Yeah, you guys have always done that, and yet they don't do that in breast. But once you're HER2 positive, in general, I think they still consider them HER2 positive. But whatever, you know, it's interesting to see as it goes into other disciplines what happens. One more question about HER2 positive disease I want to ask, and here's just, I think people are pretty familiar with the 811 trial that we've been talking about. Also, the fact that the benefit on further analysis seemed to be really confined to patients with a CPS greater than 1. We talked about the possibility of TDXD coming into first-line therapy in combination. Here's a study that looked at it as well in combination, and I guess now going into phase 2. Destiny Gastric 02 with a TDXD. Anything you want to say, Jeff, in general about what we've learned, not only about the efficacy of TDXD in gastroesophageal cancer, but particularly tolerability issues? You know, we heard a lot about acute GI toxicities, the use of olanzapine that they do a lot in breast cancer. And of course, the issue of interstitial lung disease. And here's another study looking at first-line TDXD. That was what we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. But Jeff, how has TDXD played out efficacy and tolerability-wise?
Yeah, I think the efficacy, I think it is certainly, you know, a game changer, but I think you actually highlighted the two toxicities that I think we all need to be aware of. I think the interstitial lung disease, paradoxically, I think, you know, people are actually more aware of it because it occurs in multiple tumor types. You know, we know that it's about 10%, and some of the events are grade 5, and patients rarely die from it. But I think actually what's underappreciated is the GI toxicities. And the I saw a new visit the other day, you know, and the patient and the family said, oh, you know, our oncologist told us that TDXD should be really well tolerated. And I said, no, not really. It's the nausea and the vomiting are substantial. And the patient actually was relieved to hear that because they were having a very, very tough time. So absolutely, things like olanzapine, things like aprepitant in addition to, you know, palonosetron. I mean, you know, those are all pre-medications we give. I mean, the olanzapine is a delayed emesis medication that patients can take. But, you know, it's, you know, I think what we sometimes forget about TDXD is that there is a very potent cytotoxic chemotherapy attached to the trastuzumab, and it has very real chemotherapy toxicities, certainly GI toxicities, but, you know, even myelosuppression. So I think, you know, it absolutely is important to keep that in mind.
So, Zev, you know, now first-line therapy of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer is an IO plus ADC, pembro plus enfortumab. And there's a lot of interest. There's a paper going to be presented with sacituzumab and IO and breast cancer at ASCO. And here we see TDXD with IO. Any thoughts about, do you think there's a synergy with IO and chemo or IO and ADC, Zev?
I think there probably is some, particularly in those PD-L1 expressing, you know, HER2 positive patients. So that's the majority of these. So I would expect some synergy to emerge. I think the difference maybe is, you know, compared to these other cancers, right? We've always known that platinum therapy is and fluoropyrimidine therapy, these are mainstays of gastric cancer. And so HER2 positive gastric cancer is very sensitive to platinum and 5-FU. So taking it away, which is what we're essentially trying to do, starting with the platinum, but in those other cancers, taking chemo away entirely will not be as easy in gastric cancer, in my opinion. And so, you know, we'll have to do those trials very, very thoughtfully and see. I know that these trials are going to front line, as you alluded to, with TDXD and various combinations. Getting away without the full complement of chemotherapy in gastric cancer, I think, will be a little harder to do than it has been in the other cancers you mentioned.
So we shall see. One more question about HER2-positive disease, Jeff. We recently did a webinar on biliary tract cancer and got into the issue of HER2-positive biliary tract cancer, where the really fascinating agent, zanidatamab, a bispecific, is approved and used. We talked about it. Seems very efficacious, but also seems very well tolerated. You don't have the ILD that you see with TDXD. So it's a pretty interesting discussion there about zanidatamab versus, for example, TDXD. Jeff, can you talk a little bit about what this molecule actually is? And we know it's very effective in biliary. What about gastroesophageal?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's also similarly active. So it's actually interesting. You know, it's, I mean, the way I thought about it initially is that it's a bispecific, but it's a subgroup of bispecifics called biparatopic, which means that each arm binds to the same antigen or protein, just a different domain. So essentially, it's somewhat like having trastuzumab and pertuzumab on the same antibody. And you might think, well, why don't we just combine trastuzumab and pertuzumab? And those studies were done in gastric and they were negative. But the way this molecule was designed, it's that it's supposed to be more, it's synergistic. I mean, it's more than just trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And so the phase one data, you know, that I think you maybe alluded to, were actually extremely promising. The phase one data suggested about a 35 to 40% response rate as monotherapy in a treatment refractory population. And again, it's not, there's no chemotherapy component to it. It's just an antibody. So there are also, and I think this is the slide that you're showing. So there was a phase two study that was done in the U.S. Looking at zanidatamab with, you know, one of three chemotherapy combinations, and an updated analysis where for the first time I think we actually present the overall survival. That's going to be at ASCO, and I think it's going to be simultaneously published in Lancet Oncology. But the results are extremely encouraging. Now, the one thing I would say, you know, is that zanidatamab monotherapy is very, very well tolerated, but when combined with a fluoropyrimidine, you know, the diarrhea rate is actually quite substantial. And I think a lot of the learnings from the phase two study really were learning how to manage the diarrhea, but essentially patients required mandatory, you know, loperamide prophylaxis for the first 1 or 2 weeks to make the diarrhea tolerable. But you know, if you can manage the diarrhea, again, it seems to be a highly active drug, and you know, these phase two data, you know, led to a phase three global study that completed accrual a couple of months ago.
And yeah, so pretty impressive looking waterfall plot, spider plot. Here's the PFS, also overall survival. We talked about, you mentioned the diarrhea, at least in combination with the 5F or fluoropyrimidine, but yeah. Other than that, when it's monotherapy, very well tolerated. And here's the big phase three trial, which right. Interestingly, the control arm, we were just talking about Pembro, trastuzumab chemo, but here, I guess, unfortunately, it came out before that came out, so there's no IO. So any thoughts on zanidatamab, Zev, would you like to be able to use it in your patients with gastroesophageal cancer in the recurrent setting?
Yeah, I mean, both the recurrent setting and the frontline setting. I think that, you know, most of the data here is frontline now with chemo, so it looks very active in those phase two studies. This is the one we'll be waiting for, and we'll be looking out for this result. It'll be one of our next largest studies in HER2-positive gastric cancer. So we'll wait and see.
So I want to move on now and talk about immunotherapy and MSS-stable, but also MSI-high disease and gastroesophageal cancer. We're going to get back to a case. This is Dr. Giffey.
This is a 75-year-old gentleman with stage 4 esophageal adenocarcinoma diagnosed on liver biopsy in 2021. HER2 negative, CPS 5%, and TPS less than 1. So he received standard of care FOLFOX with nivolumab, and he reached a complete response within about 4 months. He got about 10 doses of oxaliplatin and then continued on 5-FU nivolumab maintenance. And then eventually he dropped the 5-FU about 2 years into therapy. And finally, after about 3.5 years of therapy, we dropped the nivolumab. And he's now on nothing and still in a complete remission 4 years after diagnosis.
Wow.
My question is, so this is a gentleman who I did not expect to have this outcome with a CPS of 5%. And does the low CPS change how you think about stopping 5-FU? The reason I asked that is when we stopped it, I was very worried that the 5-FU was doing more at keeping his disease at bay than the nivolumab was because his CPS was so low. And does the low CPS also change how and when you think about stopping nivolumab? It makes me question, are we either measuring the wrong thing or is it how we're measuring? It's sort of like HER2 has come into question. I don't know the answer to that. And then my other question for the investigator is, do you typically use 2 years of negative scans or complete response before deciding to stop the immune checkpoint inhibitor? Do we have actual data in esophageal, or have we kind of extrapolated that to many tumor types?
And Jeff, she also brought up the issue of cell-free DNA and making this decision. So I'm not going to ask you all to, I'm just going to show the audience so you know that it's in the slide set for you to take a look at, but we've been looking at these trials for a while. I really would rather hear you talk about this case and what you're doing nowadays. So Jeff, any thoughts about this case and this situation?
Yeah, I mean, those are really great questions. And I mean, we could literally spend the entire hour just focusing on the questions that she had. So I guess I would clarify that, You know, I think that we are kind of underprivileged in gastric in the sense that we see a lot of CPS-0, we see a lot of CPS-1 tumors. So 5 really, again, I mean, in all of the studies, you know, certainly in CheckMate 649, 5 and above really was considered, you know, relatively strongly PD-L1 positive. I mean, it's rare to see CPS-10, 20 in esophagogastric adenocarcinoma. So the point to me is that, you know, I think this is a reasonably strongly positive, you know, PD-L1 positive tumor. And we know now from long-term follow-up from CheckMate 649 that, you know, I mean, there is long-term survival in up to 20 to 25% of patients. So we are doing better for a small subgroup of patients than before. So, and I think we all see this more and more in clinic, which is great. So maybe I'll jump ahead and kind of give you my spin on what to do in this very positive situation where someone's been on treatment for 2 years. So I think the 2-year number really comes from the fact that a lot of these studies, a lot of immunotherapy studies give treatment for 2 years. And then at the end of 2 years, I mean, protocol therapy ends based on the assumption that if the immune system is up and running and self-sustaining at that point, that you don't need the immunotherapy anymore, right? So I'll actually tackle the question of the ctDNA. So what I've done in these patients is that, you know, if it's been 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, and there's a decision about stopping treatment, whether it's just the nivolumab or whether it's a nivolumab with a fluoropyrimidine, you know, I try and find the least excuse to continue treatment, meaning that I'll send patients for an endoscopy if they had an intact primary tumor in the beginning. If they had positive cytology, I'll send them for a diagnostic laparoscopy. I'll consider a PET scan in addition to a CAT scan. And this is actually the one situation where I do use ctDNA. And I think if all the results are negative, then that does give me more confidence that these patients really do have a durable complete response and we can stop. But I think if any of the tests show that, you know, there's still cancer around, then I would continue. But, you know, in my experience, and I think, you know, I'm certainly interested in kind of looking at our series, if everything is negative and you stop, my anecdotal experience is that most of these patients now with 2, 3, 4 years of follow-up, they actually don't recur. So they really do have durable, complete responses to 2 years of treatment.
So, Zev, anything you want to add to that? Any comments also on tislelizumab? You know, slightly different mechanism of action. I don't know if our trials have the power to even distinguish that, and I don't think they're going to be a head-to-head comparison. But anything you want to add to what Jeff said? Any comments about Tisley?
So I think Jeff's points are very well made. I mean, I think that the way the patient was managed is kind of how I would do it too, quite frankly. That was very good management. I think, you know, you kind of try to, you don't want to stop all drugs at once. You want to tailor them off one at a time. That approach seems very logical. Totally agree with her point that, you know, there's probably much more to it than we don't understand. It's not just about PD-L1 scoring, it's about the combination thereof. And so, you know, and this points to tislelizumab. What I think tislelizumab data generally shows us it is that very, very similar performance to the other checkpoint inhibitors. And that's with using a different PD-L1 assay, using TAP scoring, which is slightly different in CPS. So by and large, there's this group of patients, and it's not just the CPS greater than 5, but that's certainly the PD-L1 greater than 5 is the best way we have to identify these people. And that's the group of patients in which some of them are going to be fortunate enough to end up in a CR. So I look at tislelizumab just like I look at Pembro and Nivo now, fairly interchangeably in my view. I also sort of look at these long-term survivors as you know, you want to get them off treatment and try to do it in a very judicious fashion. The reason why 2 years was set up, though, is that that's what the original trials utilized. So that's kind of where this comes from. So the FDA has a label of 2 years. If technically going past 2 years, you can, and we all do it in the real world, but that's sort of where other companies are following. So that's not always the right thing for every patient, of course.
So, Jeff, a couple of days ago, we saw this press release looking at an ADC, infinatumab, deruxtecan, now targeting B7H3. This is a phase 3 trial in esophageal squamous. Any comment on this, Jeff, and where you think it's heading?
Yeah, I mean, not so much. I mean, again, I think this was a study that was available in our phase one group. And, you know, there were reportedly anecdotal responses in patients with squamous cell cancers of the esophagus. I've not seen any of the data presented, but clearly I think it's sufficiently promising that they're launching a phase three study. But, you know, there is a recurring theme here with regards to ADCs. You know, ADCs have certainly become a major component of, you know, kind of the armamentarium, whether it's against HER2, whether it's against B7H3, which is an immune checkpoint molecule, and then whether it's against even, you know, Claudin 18.2, which we'll discuss toward the end. We certainly need more treatments, you know, in squamous cell cancers of the esophagus, where there really are a dearth of targets.
Let's talk a little bit about immunotherapy and MSI-high disease. We talk about the excitement that we're about to see some data in the adjuvant setting with colon now at ASCO finally. But there are so many questions out there now, so many great cases I've heard over the years, last few years, with IOs and MSI-high disease. Here's Dr. Pelez with a 63-year-old man.
This 63-year-old gentleman presented quite unwell. He was having abdominal pain. He had lost a lot of weight. He, you know, works out in the farmlands out near Okeechobee. And, you know, I think there was, you know, delay in him presenting for medical care and getting a diagnosis. CAT scan showed a very large gastric mass, you know, rising from the wall of the stomach. He had an upper endoscopy, and not my words, but the endoscopist report said he had a gargantuan malignant ulcer extending from the distal gastric antrum and into the duodenal bulb. Wow. Biopsy positive for adenocarcinoma. MLH1 and PMS2 staining were absent. He was also positive for H. pylori. So he, you know, immediately began treatment for H. pylori. So in view of the borderline resectability, positive node, and the absent MMR staining, I started him on FOLFOX with nivolumab. He's had 4 cycles of that. He's had a partial remission. So in consultation with the surgeon, we decided to continue treatment. So, you know, question here is, would you have started him on chemoimmunotherapy, or would you have placed a patient like this with MMR deficiency on just a checkpoint inhibitor or potentially combination IO therapy with ipi/nivo, for example? A good question here would be, if he was clearly resectable, would you send him for surgery initially, or would you give him immunotherapy first and then send him for surgery or immunotherapy in, you know, an adjuvant setting?
So, of course, you know, Zev, we've seen a revolution in terms of MSI-high rectal cancer. Now I'm hearing people talk about MSI-high other GI cancers, including gastroesophageal, using upfront IO, maybe even in resectable disease. I'm not going to ask you to go back over the CheckMate 649 study, but I am going to show it while you chat about this case. Any thoughts, Zev?
Yeah, I mean, the case that he's describing is a resectable, curable patient. And I think, you know, that patient also falls within the Matterhorn study, right? So we're going to see some data like we alluded to earlier with the addition of durvalumab in particular in that case. You have many different directions to go in that patient, Neil. You can say to a patient, hey, gosh, if they're completely resectable, you can just take the tumor out. And we know that those folks do really well with such surgery alone. Sometimes don't even need any adjuvant therapy at all. If the patient's not resectable and you're going for an organ preservation approach, which sometimes is esophagectomies obviously aren't suitable for everybody. We now have 2 small data sets, both from France and Italy, showing that combination immunotherapy with a checkpoint and a CTLA-4 combination has a high rate of pathological complete response in the patients who are going to surgery. So I think we're waiting to see more long-term results from the studies. We're waiting to see if we can get away without a surgery in a large segment of these patients with MSI-high disease. That's going to take a number of years because it's quite a rare entity. But I think certainly treating them with chemoimmunotherapy up front makes sense, and making a decision after that about, you know, suitable surgical resection would be a way I would go.
So, Jeff, any comments? And, you know, I think my take on this was that the patient actually wasn't really resectable in this situation, but they were trying to maybe make them potentially resectable. A couple of people in the chat room, Jeff, also asking about the Memorial experience that was published in the New England Journal looking at MSI-high tumors. So, Jeff, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think I was going to allude to that. I mean, I definitely agree with Zev. So I think there are probably, I guess when I think about this, there are probably two things. You know, I mean, are we doing this? So if it's completely unresectable, then it would technically fall into the category of palliative, although we know that there's a very high chance of response. But I think the more intriguing question is that if it's clearly resectable, are we doing this as preoperative therapy, or are we doing this as definitive therapy in lieu of surgery if the patient has a complete response, right? So, and then I think the second question is, you know, do we do, as in this case, in a FLOT or full FLOX, with immunotherapy, do we do combination? So I think Zev, you know, alluded to two data sets. The French gave ipi-nivo, the Italians gave dovatremi, and they had pathologic complete response rates of about 60% at the time of surgery. But they only gave about 3 months of preoperative therapy. And then finally, now there's, you know, our series that, you know, my friend and colleague Andrea Sirsak published, where, you know, I think there were about 100 plus patients, 15 of whom had, you know, esophageal gastric tumors, where we gave up to 6 months of dostarlimab. So again, it's 6 months of a PD-1 inhibitor versus 2 to 3 months of combination. And, you know, the majority of patients, you know, who, you know, well, so the majority of patients who had achieved a complete response elected not to have surgery. We followed them and they've not developed local recurrence. But certainly no one in that series, and that included GYN and GU MSI tumors, no one lost the opportunity to have surgery because they received the dostarlimab for 6 months. So I actually think that it's an exciting time for the field. And I think ultimately, you know, this, you know, these patients, and they're comprised about 7 to 8% of patients with localized disease, I think they have more options than even a couple of years ago. But I think it's exciting, you know, the idea of organ sparing and avoiding, you know, certainly an esophagectomy, but even a gastrectomy. I think that's something that's on the horizon and being kind of closely looked at.
So one more thing before we get to Claude and Zev. Just getting back to first-line therapy and metastatic disease, it's been my impression talking to investigators that for patients who can tolerate it, younger patients couldn't, and without a whole lot of comorbidities, that ipi-nivo has been favored. Is that your favorite approach for first-line therapy of MSI-high disease, Zev?
In metastatic disease, yes. I think that in metastatic disease, there's a big debate if you can ipi-nivo versus single agent pembro versus chemo-nivo. So it's got to be a clinical decision, right? I think it's got to be based on bulk of disease. It's got to be based on, you know, whether someone can handle the dual combination. But the ipi-nivo regimen is pretty well tolerated by and large. We've got, you know, pretty good survival data in that group of patients. So I like to avoid chemo if I can in that patient population.
All right, so Claudin 18.2 with zolbetuximab now being available, and I've been hearing some pretty interesting stories about docs in practice giving their first patient zolbetuximab. Here's an example with Dr. Malik.
This patient was initially started on treatment with 5-fluorouracil, oxaliplatinum, and pembrolizumab. After his first 4 cycles on a repeat imaging test, showed almost a complete response. Within 2 to 3 cycles of therapy, he was able to start swallowing. He started eating a normal diet, so was really happy about that. Initially, we had placed a PEG tube in him to be able to get him some nutrition to get him stronger for treatment. He did very well for about 8 to 10 months on therapy, and then his CEA markers started elevating. I repeated a PET scan, and it started showing some slight increased growth in the lymph nodes and in his liver lesion. So in the meantime, zolbetuximab got approved in this setting, and he did have a Claudin 18.2 mutation. So I decided to give him 5-fluorouracil and zolbetuximab combination. I was actually right by his side for pretty much most of the infusion. About 45 minutes into the infusion, he did have those significant side effects that are mentioned on the drug label for this drug. He had significant nausea. He said he felt like there was a fist in his abdomen. He had some vomiting. And then I went ahead and, you know, gave him some steroids, some Benadryl. We actually gave him some atropine, which really helped calm down that side effect. But it was pretty intense, lasted about 30 to 45 minutes. So he went on to receive about two more treatments. His CEA has decreased, and he is currently due for a PET scan in the next week or two.
So what are the questions you have about this case?
What are some thoughts in regards to how we can handle this in our infusion centers and have our nurses be ready for this as well?
Any other questions for the faculty?
What would be the best first-line treatment for this patient if they had a high PD-L1 score?
So I should have mentioned before, Jeff, this patient's CPS was 20. And so any thoughts about the case? Any thoughts about what happened there in terms of the GI side effects? Have you seen atropine be helpful? I haven't heard that one before. What about slowing the infusion rate? And what are you going to do in the future for a case like this? IO, zolbetuximab, I don't know, both?
You know, none of these questions are straightforward. So I guess I'll relay a conversation I had with a patient just yesterday. I said, listen, the good news and the bad news is that your tumor is claudin positive and we managed to get zolbetuximab approved for you. I mean, again, we know the data from the two studies, which are Spotlight and GLOW. And again, they were two parallel studies. The only difference was that Spotlight used FOLFOX and GLOW used CAPOX. And both studies were positive and ultimately helped patients to live longer. So, you know, drug was approved in October and we're seeing it more and more. But what she described is exactly what, you know, what patients are experiencing. It's a long, complicated infusion, sometimes to the degree that, you know, if a patient reacts, then you have to, you know, pause it and then you have to kind of restart it and give additional pre-medications. I mean, it can be sufficiently difficult that you actually end up having to split up the zolbetuximab and the chemotherapy because there just isn't enough time in the day to give both. So patients have to come back now the second day to receive, you know, FOLFOX or oxaliplatin. So that's one issue, you know, but if that were the least of it, I mean, I think it would be okay. But, you know, in addition to kind of infusion-related reactions, patients develop paroxysmal nausea and vomiting in the chemotherapy chair. They become acutely nauseated. And so part of it is really giving all the antiemetics that we have, you know, before the start of the infusion. We also give, you know, Tylenol and Benadryl to prevent IRRs. And we send patients home with, you know, dexamethasone as well as olanzapine. And because, I mean, you know, the mechanism of the nausea is not clear, certainly we think that some component of it actually is actually actual gastritis because claudin 18.2 is also expressed at low levels on normal gastric tissue. Why patients don't experience classic gastritis symptoms, why they have nausea, vomiting, I think we really don't know. But we also make sure that patients are at a minimum on a PPI twice daily to try and, you know, reduce all of these symptoms. The phase three data would suggest that the nausea kind of slowly extinguishes by the second or third treatment. It's significantly better. So the idea really is to hopefully get patients through 4 to 6 weeks of treatment, and then subsequently, you know, the symptoms will get better. The last thing which I would mention, and I'm doing this really in the absence of data, the way the drug is given, it's a loading dose of 800 milligrams per meter squared. And then 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, then there's a maintenance dose of 400 milligrams per meter squared every 2 weeks. I actually omit the loading dose and just start with the maintenance dose. It reduces the infusion time. I'm hoping that it will help reduce, you know, nausea symptoms. This strategy actually is the basis of a completed phase two study. Hopefully, I mean, that's one strategy maybe to try and, you know, make things a little bit more tolerable for patients.
So, Zev, anything you want to add to that? Do you see less nausea and vomiting if the patients have had their stomach removed? And again, what do you do if their CPS is positive and they're 18.2? While you chat about that, I'll just flip through some of the slides on Zolbi that we've talked about before, and you can check this out. But any thoughts, Zev?
Yeah, it's a good synopsis by Jeff. I mean, this is a class effect of any anti-claudin therapies, so we're starting to see this with the antibody-drug conjugates as well. We know that there is some element of tachyphylaxis to this, which means that subsequent dosing gets a little bit easier than the first dose. That seems to be fairly reproducible amongst the zolbetuximab data sets. And we also know, as you alluded to, Neil, that patients who have had a total gastrectomy and essentially have less gastric tissue in their body are less susceptible to this extreme side effect of nausea, vomiting. It doesn't mean they won't get any, but it's certainly less intense. All of the tricks of the trade that Jeff alluded to make sense to me. We also tend to give a little lorazepam pre-treatment as well, because there isn't a lot of anxiety that happens as they start to feel ill. And so, this toxicity is not something we're accustomed to seeing. We haven't seen it in a long time. It is an active drug. And we know that there are certain patients, particularly high expressors, who get who have a survival advantage. With regard to your question, though, Neil, fundamentally, I would manage that patient with a checkpoint inhibitor up front and not give them zolbetuximab up front with that degree of a CPS elevation. We're waiting. We're just starting the enrollment now of the combination of all three of these combinations, chemo, IO, plus or minus zolbetuximab in those patients. But in the absence of a reason to, I would not give that patient upfront zolbetuximab with that high CPS score. And I would reserve it for patients who really have a low CPS score in the upfront patient population.
So, Jeff, we were talking about other agents that target Claudin. I know you all at Memorial have looked at CAR-T targeting Claudin. I think there's going to be a report at that at ASCO. But what about this antibody-drug conjugate? It doesn't have a name yet, but pretty impressive waterfall plot. Any thoughts in terms of toxicity as well as efficacy, Jeff?
Yeah, I think the ADC story, again, I think we're seeing it now with multiple targets. And, there are actually, I think at last count, there were about 30 or 40 novel anti-claudin therapies. And one big bucket is the ADCs. And actually, I think a lot of them were developed in China and then kind of licensed. I think that's the case with the AstraZeneca drug. Elevation Oncology, a small company, had another drug. They actually discontinued it. I think, all of the drugs, I think, have about the same, 35, 40% response rates. The PFS and the duration of response seem encouraging. But again, I think, and Zev mentioned this, and we've been talking about this, I do worry about the toxicity. I think that the gastritis is a class effect because, there is claudin expression on normal gastric tissue. And, we will have to see how it plays out. We're now delivering, strong chemotherapy through the ADC directly to the gastric mucosa. How tolerable is it going to be? I think the discontinuation rate, the toxicities rates, I think these issues are really going to determine, whether these drugs are active and have a established role or not.
So actually, we see a randomized study is going to look at this very interesting agent. We'll see what that shows, that both in efficacy, but as you point out, tolerability. So Jeff and Zev, thank you so much. There's so much to talk about, and we just sort of glazed through that. Hopefully, it was helpful to everybody. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe. Stay well. And have a great night. Thanks so much, Jeff. Thanks, Zev.
Thank you very much. It was great to be with you guys.
Thanks, Neil. Bye, everybody.